Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Stuart Senator of Munger, Tolles & Olson, representing Verizon Communications and GT Corp.
So tell us what's going on here.
These plaintiffs, all former employees of GTE Corporation, were participants in GTE's ESOP, which was an ERISA plan.
Why was it an ERISA plan? How do we know it's an ERISA plan?
Well, we have the plan documents.
Okay, you have a document, but an ERISA plan has a definition, and it has to be, as I understand it, it is not just an employee benefit plan, as you know. It has to be an employee benefit plan which provides essentially contingent benefits on for disability, retirement, severance, and so on. Here we have money that is being stock that is being transferred and allocated to individuals and held in their name, and moreover have some kind of an ownership interest because they can vote it immediately, and moreover they can, after 7 years, without any of those contingencies, get the distribution. Is that not right?
It's partially right. This is a plan where...
Has this ever been adjudicated to be an ERISA plan? Is there any case of something like this being adjudicated to be an ERISA plan?
Well, let me start with the point that there's never been any dispute in this case that it is an ERISA plan.
I understand that because the defendant, but we have a jurisdictional problem, and if it's not an ERISA plan, we don't have jurisdiction.
Right. But at the beginning, they can. It's not a plan where the stock is or the money is just put into the plan and then they can withdraw that.
But they can withdraw 7 years later without any of the ERISA contingent.
In certain circumstances, there's a provision that they can withdraw within 7 years. Otherwise, that they can request some withdrawals. They can withdraw on their death, disability, separation for the company, or they're required to withdraw when they reach age 70 and a half.
But it's their money that they can get within the 7 years. And I myself will have done an awful lot of ERISA work. I've not seen an ERISA plan that looks that way. At least it seems to me, and we'd have to do some briefing and some understanding of this because I've never seen one like it. Have you? I mean, is there any case you can point to that says that something in which money is allocated, the stock's allocated, you can vote the stock and you can get the stock out in 7 years with none of the ERISA contingencies is an ERISA plan?
I believe, Your Honor, that there was only, I'm turning now to try to get to that provision about the 7 years because it wasn't, well, let me get to it first.
Let me suggest that if we're going to pursue this, we'll ask for further briefing, and why don't we get to the issues that were briefed?
That's fine, Your Honor.
Does it matter if it's an ERISA plan?
Well, I think once it's been conceded...
It matters to you a lot, but...
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I know it might matter in terms of removal in one sense, but how do you get around Caterpillar's approach? They have a well-pleaded complaint. They're claiming state cause action only. They don't have to go to the plan itself. And you say, oh, yeah, but it's a plan. That sounds a lot like the Caterpillar problem.
It's completely preempted under the series of cases.
It's not preempted. It's only preempted if they're suing on your ERISA plan. But it's not completely preempted if they're bringing a different lawsuit, which they purport to be doing. They might be wrong, but that's what they purport to be doing.
They can't recharacterize it and therefore avoid the fact that it's essentially a claim for benefits under the ERISA.
But why is it a claim for benefits? They have alleged, this is also a 12b6 case, or in another version like a 12b6 case, in which we're dealing with a complaint. And their complaint says that we are owners of the stock. Now, you say, well, you're only owners of the stock because of the ESOP plan. Well, that certainly wouldn't matter if it were actually distributed, and it may or may not matter if it were allocated, where they got the stock from. But they're just not talking about that in their complaint. They're saying we are owners. And maybe they're not owners. Maybe that turns out to be wrong, but that's what they're alleging. And in all of their complaints, they allege that. And they're alleging that you mishandled and properly transferred and failed to deliver the stock. I don't know what failed to deliver means. Maybe it means distribute, but it may also mean we are owners on the books of the company, but they never gave us the stock certificate. If that were true, for all we know, there was an internal distribution that actually occurred, but you never gave them the stock certificate. So from anything that's in this complaint, there's nothing that seems to implicate necessarily, it may turn out to, but not necessarily, the ESOP plan.
Well, But they are claiming they never got the stock. That's the core of their complaint is we were entitled to stock, as it turns out, under this ESOP.
Stock mean? Does it mean a piece of paper, a stock certificate, or does it mean the ownership interest? They allege that they had the ownership interest all along. They say that exactly.
They allege they should have been owners. They
no,
were
they
entitled
they
to be owners.
They had ownership interest, but you never gave them the stock.
They say plaintiffs in class never received the stock. They never received the benefits. We held it as a fiduciary. We held that those securities. It was in our custody. It was never turned over to them. And if this were a typical garden variety and characterized as a case where they're just in, where they are already owners of stock and therefore they're just entitled to bring these sorts of claims.
They've never received notice or any information regarding their stock ownership interest in GTE. They're not, they're saying the failed to inform of your stock ownership. They're not saying that they didn't own it. They're saying that you mishandled their ownership.
They're saying they didn't get it.
They didn't physically get it. That's a different question.
Well, if you could transform a claim for benefits by saying, we never got it, we really should have gotten it, that would apply in any case under this ESOP. It would apply.
What were the benefits here? What were the benefits?
The benefits were there was stock held in these accounts, stock allocated to particular individuals, fractional.
Did the workers know that this was being done?
Yes, they received yearly statements.
They received yearly statements.
Under the plan, they would receive yearly statements saying this many shares, this many fractional shares, this much cash is allocated to your, to you under the plan. You don't have it, but it's allocated and being managed by the fiduciary.
Individually.
They received individual statements.
But
then the fiduciary, the trust, would be the one that voted in the proxies, that received the corporate communications.
I thought that they could vote their own stock. I thought that that's what the plan said.
Now, the plan says that they will be given, that the corporation will give notice to the plan, to the fiduciary. Then, in turn, the plan will give notice to the individuals and try to give notice in a similar form to that by which the corporation or the plan got notice. Then it's a two-step process. The employee tells the trustee how the employee wants his or her stock voted.
That certainly suggests some ownership interest. I mean, isn't there an SEC problem with somebody who isn't really an owner voting stock?
Well, they are not voting the stock. They are telling the fiduciary how they want the stock voted, and under the plan, the fiduciary has committed to voting it in that manner.
Well, what were they going to get in the end? Say they retired.
Say they retired, and they then at, say, age 70 and a half, if you're required to, or earlier, they would make a request to start having benefits paid out to them.
But what were they going to get? They're going to get all the stock at that time?
They could get it paid out in stock, yes. They'd also have some cash from dividends and the like, and they could get that paid out. There were fractional shares that they were, quote, were allocated to them. Those would be converted to cash and then paid out to them as well.
I'm reading from the original complaint now. It says, within the last 18 months, plaintiffs learned that they owned stock in GTE that had been transferred and sold without their knowledge. That's the allegation. They say that they were minority shareholders. They say that they mishandled and failed to properly transfer shares of stock. They say that they were unaware of the stock that had been, they did not receive and were unaware of stock that had been improperly transferred. They didn't receive indicia of stock ownership. But of course, there's a difference between indicia of stock ownership and stock ownership. And they repeatedly alleged that they were owners of this stock. So as a complaint, looked at as a complaint, it's very hard to tell why this depends on the ESA.
Well, if ownership, as they say, it's a legal conclusion. You have to look at the facts that they allege in support of that conclusion. And I refer you to paragraph 42. Each of the class members entered into an employment relationship with GTE that entitled them to GTE and Verizon's fringe benefits on a non-discriminatory basis as set forth in the employee handbook, which could change at GTE and Verizon's sole discretion as the companies deemed necessary. Each and every plaintiff and class member was unaware of the stock in the company that had been assigned to them. GTE, Verizon, and defendants either negligently or intentionally failed to inform plaintiffs and class members of that stock ownership. Then we have a number of other paragraphs that are the same thing.
Right, and
this is a fringe benefit, and you fail to tell us about the fringe benefit.
If, for example, the stock had actually, they had, when they left, had been distributed as it should have been, this whole complaint, this whole paragraph would apply to that, right?
If the stock had been distributed to them, if they had made a claim to the plan and said, I terminated my employment, please distribute this, then they would have gotten that stock.
Here's the problem.
They're saying they didn't, so that's what the case is about.
I agree. They're saying they did not get that stock from the plan that they should have gotten, and that's a claim for benefits. They're saying, what they should have done is they should have gone to the plan, and they could have done this and filed a form and said, you've been sending me these yearly statements saying I'm entitled to X number of shares. Now, pay up.
Okay. Here's the problem. There are all kinds of ways that employers can give employees stock. There are 401k plans. There are other kinds of stock purchase plans. There are all kinds of ways. They don't have to be ERISA plans. I'm not saying whether this one is or not. That's not even relevant to my question or point. So if the employer said, I will give my employees 10 shares of stock each year, that's all, and that's what it does, there you have a non-ERISA plan, probably, with the stock coming out to the employees. Their pleading could as well cover that situation as it does cover an ERISA plan situation. That's what they pled. It seems to me that when they come in and make that, I think it's a problem anyway, if they come in and make that kind of pleading in state court, then you can say, no, this would have come to them under ERISA plan, and you can do that as a defense. But that's what Caterpillar was about. Sometimes they've chosen their pleading. They can plead and say what they want. They might turn out to be dead wrong, and you have to defend. That's not, doesn't make it removable. That's my point.
I agree that we can assert a defense of preemption in state court. I also believe that when they are in fact claiming under an ERISA plan, we can remove under the well-pleaded complaint rule that if they had properly pleaded the complaint would have disclosed, as they say, there's a benefit plan under the employee handbook, and it would have attached that employee handbook, it would have shown what the benefit plan was, and it would have shown that it's an ERISA plan. And indeed, on the sort of plan summary document.
That's not what their claim is, that they own this stock and that you gave it to the state. That's where their focus is. Now, you can come back and say, well, no, you didn't own the stock. And that you would really have an ERISA plan defense at that point. You didn't own the stock because you weren't entitled to an ERISA plan. But they say that they own the stock.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that puts a huge hole in the ERISA preemption line of cases. The cases do not, continue to say you can't dress up an ERISA plan.
But the focus in this case is on the movement from the company to the state and not on getting the money out of the company, out of the plan to begin with. That's where they're placing the focus. Now, you may have a defense that, well, you can't complain about us giving something to the state that you never owned. But their complaint is we owned it and you gave it to the state. Now, you can disprove that. You never owned it. But that's completely different than most ERISA cases because the focus is over here. It's on the fact that we own something you gave to the state, not on the fact that you kept it for yourself rather than giving it to us.
Whatever reason they didn't get it, there was a benefit they were entitled to, or they claim they were entitled to, as an employee fringe benefit, which turns out to be their ERISA plan. They claim they were entitled to it, and they claimed they didn't get it. That is the essence.
They claim that they, I understand what you're saying.
I understand they're saying we should have been shareholders, and they're even saying, well, we think we, quote, are shareholders because the plan gave us entitlement to this. But the ERISA preemption test should not depend upon how they characterize that relationship. It should depend on the underlying facts.
If, for example, the allocation that did it definitely occurred were sufficient to give them an ownership interest for purposes of state security laws, then why would ERISA or ESOP matter at all if they could prove that up?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just didn't hear that over the
allocation that did occur. were sufficient to give them an ownership interest for purposes of state or federal securities law, for example, then why would anything about ERISA matter? They had already gotten something.
I don't believe that it did, Your Honor. I believe
that's
under the plan.
That's what we're going to litigate. Oh, that's what you're going to litigate.
I'm sorry?
That's what you can litigate. But
well, but you've got the plan document that puts the shares in the plan. I'm sorry, again, I didn't hear.
What I'm saying is that's the merits of the case. The complaint would cover that allegation, would it not?
The complaint covers it. It alleges some legal conclusions. Under the case law, you're also allowed to, and this Court has said, should consider the plan documents in conjunction with our motion, as the district court did. And under the plan documents, you see that the shares do indeed go to the plan. They're held by the trust. They are paid out at age 70 and a half, paid out at termination of employment and the like.
Counsel, let me ask you a slightly different question. It may be on the same basic path. They've now put in a federal securities claim. I take it that if you're correct, that this is really an ERISA claim, or it's really an ERISA plan situation that's being fought about, their federal securities claim is also no good, not because it's preempted, but just because you can't bring federal securities claims for securities in an ERISA plan.
I agree for a number of reasons they have no federal securities. Their federal securities claim fails.
Okay.
And fundamentally, yes, they're not buying and selling securities, which is what the federal securities law covers in a variety of different contexts, and they haven't come up with any theory for how they are falling underneath that federal securities law.
Okay.
So tell me what happened here. Now, the shares that were allocated to the fund but were earmarked for the various employees, so they ended up with...
I can't hear you.
The shares that were earmarked for the various employees and with the trustee, how did they all end up with the state?
Well, Your Honor, we didn't get into discovery, and I don't think I can, consistent with the record, give you some sort of explanation of how and if some shares ended up with the state and what happened with those shares. I can tell you, under the plan, if a shareholder, and this is page 247 of the excerpts, if a plan participant thinks they're entitled to benefits, thinks they're lost to the corporation, the plan says those shares go back into the general fund of the plan once the participants are lost to the plan. The plan can't find them to reduce overall plan expenses, meaning the company doesn't have to contribute proportionately more shares when there are more participants in the plan. But then if the participant comes back and says, here I am, you lost me, but here I am, at any time after that 36-month period, at any time, they just make a claim and say, here I am, the shares from the plan will be reinstated. So it doesn't really matter what the company is internally doing and how they've handled these shares under the plan. If a claim is made and it's a valid claim, the fact that the person has been lost to the corporation is irrelevant. Under the ESOP plan, the benefits are reinstated.
So how did the shares end up in the coffers of the state?
I don't know, Your Honor.
You don't know?
If the company sent some shares to the state with these folks' names on it, that's, in our view, a separate issue.
Issue that the law is about. That's the only issue that the case is about, as I understand it.
Well, they said we, as employees, never got this benefit to which we were entitled to.
No, they didn't say that. They said we got the benefit, but you gave it to the state.
Well, they said we never received it. They're saying we should have gotten it. You maybe internally allocated it,
right,
but you never sent it to us.
And you gave it to the state.
What we did with it, you know, assuming these allegations, what we did with it is our problem in that circumstance, or the plan's problem. If they haven't made a claim to the plan, they make a claim to the plan, and that's how it's dealt with.
Maybe there's a conceptual question here, which is, I'm reading this complaint in a Conley versus Gibson way, i.e., is there any conceivable theory on which it could succeed. Now, is there anything wrong with reading the complaint in this context in that fashion?
I think you have to look at it in conjunction with ESOP documents under Perino and the other cases that allow you to look at the plan documents, and I don't think that that's a reasonable reading of the complaint in conjunction with the plan documents.
But they haven't brought in the plan documents. You have.
Correct. They're, just like in Perino there, where somebody was claiming benefits and the defendant came in and said, here are the plan documents on Rule 12b-6, and the court, after removal, the same scenario we have here, and the court said it's fine to consider these.
But even given the plan documents, there are still several ways that you could read this complaint, even given the plan documents. One of them is this was allocated, and the allocation is sufficient to give me an ownership interest under the state and federal statutes that I'm claiming under. That may be wrong, but it's an allegation. The second one is that, in fact, it was distributed to me under the plan, except that I never got the piece of paper. That's another way one could possibly read it. If you read either of those two ways, then it seems to me the plan drops out, and then you have legal questions about whether there was whatever ownership interest they had at any particular time was properly escheated to the state or not. And for us to be accepting your version of what this complaint might mean, except the others, seems to me to be contrary to notice pleading and to Comey versus Gibson and to 75 years of law.
Well, I think the response to that, Your Honor, is that you're taking their legal conclusions or their allegations of law, if you will, about ownership and things of that sort as sufficient, whereas I'm saying, well, you have to look at the allegations of fact, and you can't just say, well, then they allege this legal conclusion, and therefore that constitutes ownership sufficient under the securities law. You have to look at the facts and say, under these facts, they're saying there was an employee benefit plan, I was entitled to something under that plan, I didn't get it. And now here's what I understand to be the reasons why I didn't get it in their internal machinations, but I didn't get it. And my point is that I didn't get it.
Further ambiguity, because we're dealing with stock, about what does I didn't get it mean. Does it mean I didn't get the piece of paper, or does it mean that it was never on the books of the company, I was not recorded as an owner? I mean, that's not clear either.
They're saying I didn't get anything. I never received a single thing. Whatever it is I should have gotten, I got nothing. And indeed, the reason they're so emphatic about that is to get around their statute of limitations problem. They're saying, or they're trying to say, I was completely not on notice of this. I didn't get anything. I never heard anything.
And for that, you're relying on paragraph 42 of the original complaint?
That's one of the paragraphs. Paragraph 25, plaintiffs in class never received notice or any information regarding their stock. Paragraph 28, Verizon, GTE and Verizon mishandled and altogether failed to deliver the stock. Paragraph 35B, GTE, Verizon, and defendants negligently or intentionally failed to inform plaintiffs and class members of their stock ownership. Paragraphs 101.
Let's suppose, would this scenario be consistent with the complaint if it existed? The company distributed this money to these individuals on your books, but the secretary forgot to send them any notice of that or any piece of paper recording their stock ownership.
Would that be consistent with their allegations?
I think it would be.
I wouldn't say it's inconsistent with their allegations.
I'm sorry?
I wouldn't say it's inconsistent. They're saying we didn't get anything.
So that scenario, doing a Comey versus Gibson on this, states a non-preempted complaint, and you know, if that's not true, they lose.
Under the variety of cases that we cited in our brief about dressing up an ERISA claim, you can't take an ERISA claim saying we should have gotten these benefits, dress it up and say, but in reality we're talking about something different, and turn it into a state law case. And my point is here, you know, say you complain to a business about I never got something, and the business says, oh, well, let me tell you about how we screwed up. And I'm not saying that my client screwed up. I'm taking allegations of the complaint as true here. The business says, let me tell you how we screwed up and why you didn't get it. Your response is, I don't care why you screwed up. Just fix the problem and give me what I'm entitled to. You're entitled to the benefits. Give them to me.
Stock ownership has its own ambiguity. I mean, people lose records of stock ownership all the time, but they don't lose the ownership interest.
And these people never got those records to lose.
But they,
that's what they're complaining about.
They didn't get the ownership interest.
I'm sorry?
That doesn't mean they didn't get the ownership interest.
Well, they were clearly, or according to the allegations and the plan documents, they would have been allocated some sort of ownership interest. That the fiduciary, that the trust, the ERISA trust, would have then had control over and had sitting in the trust's name but allocated in internal accounts to these individuals. That would have been there. But I guess I'll sum up because my time is...
Is there anything in the trust documents that talks about shares being distributed to the states, whatever you want to call it?
There is not, Your Honor.
What?
There is not, Your Honor.
There's nothing there.
It does not say shares will be escheated to the state. The trust document.
Well, is there any provision in there that talks about transferring ownership of shares to the state under whatever circumstances?
No, the provision for the lost beneficiaries talks about if a beneficiary is entitled to benefit and they become lost to the plan, then those benefits will be redistributed into the plan to be then reinstated if the person's ever found.
So
it's sort of its own internal mechanism.
It all stays in the pot.
Huh? It all stays in the pot, correct, yeah. Your Honor. And so that's why in this situation, if they're a former employee thinking they're entitled to something, why is it such a strange phenomenon to say, come to the plan, not to the corporation, but come to the plan that was holding these things and say, I was entitled to these things. Please look at paragraph 7 of your plan and reinstate them. That's all we're saying. And that you can't then, by artful pleading, take that and dress it up and say, really, there are all these tort claims that we now have. Just come to the plan. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Judge Pragerson, you started out with the question, what happened here? We laid it out in the complaint, and I think the three judges on the panel understand that stock was issued in the name of these people. It was then transferred from the corporation to a third party, eventually to the controller, where it was sold. Along the way, there were different mileposts that required the corporation to provide notice, both under the securities laws as they were transferring and holding the stock.
So the stock was sold, and then what happened to the money?
The people tried to claim what's left of it.
No, what happened to the money? Did the corporation,
the money,
GTE put the money in its pocket?
The money is, and this is the essence of the unclaimed property law, the stock is transferred to the state. The state then is supposed to provide notice to reunite the stock to the people. And at some point, the state then sells the stock. And then what is left of the stock, the original investment, is returned to the people. And when they claim it, they then have to pay taxes, capital gains. There was, you know, when the corporation issued the stock 20 years ago to these people, they were supposed to do things like comply with IRS 1099 obligations. They were supposed to tell the people that they were getting their stock. Instead, they told them nothing. As counsel correctly noted, they gave them no information. They basically broke every rule in the book. Now, before they filed this lawsuit, the plaintiffs went to the corporation and they said, give us our stock back. And the corporation said no.
All right, so they're now saying, as I understand it, that you can go to the plan and get your stock back. So what happens then?
I think that's because they're maneuvering us into a blind alley in this kind of bizarre spin on ERISA, removing it after they've denied it the benefits, removing it, and then trying to steer us into an alleyway where they know we'll get nothing. The stock was already delivered by the corporation to the controller who then sold the stock. It's gone. It's dissipated. What, are they going to manufacture new shares and give them to these people? They'd have to dilute all the other shareholders' stock. Public policy, I'd like to touch on that very briefly. The public policy set out in Western Union Telegraph Company versus City of Davenport, 97 U.S. 369.
So you're saying that if one of your clients or a member of that class went to the trustee of the plan and said, "Oh, I'm here. I'm alive. I'm not lost. Reinstate my benefits." That they just be turned away? Is that what you're saying?
It would be it's an impossibility. How would the plan administrator give them their stock back? It's already gone from the corporation. They'd have to dilute everyone else in the plan and say, okay, well, we'll dilute everyone else so you can have another round of stock.
Well, let's go back to Judge Fernandez's questions earlier in terms of what we do with this case at this point. You now have a federal securities claim in that case. Even if we were to go look at the complaint the way it was originally and remand the original case, presumably if you leave the federal securities claim in there, they're going to just remove it the next day. So it may be that unless you tell us that you're going to remove the federal securities claim and leave it out permanently, we should just go forward in federal court.
Well, we will remove the federal securities claim. I think the opposing counsel already said that they would just move to dismiss that claim anyway. It would be a jurisdictionally defective complaint if it moved forward. What would be the point of expending the judicial resources to keep the complaint in federal court when the opposing counsel already said it's deficient and...
Well, you say it isn't. That's why.
Well, I would just simply strike it. And as I said, initially it was removed. I wasn't the counsel at the time, but it was removed on this crazy ERISA notion. And all the claims are state securities.
The other thing, of course, is that if you do go for a state court, you're going to be doing it around an ERISA preemption problem, and it's going to limit the nature of the litigation because if you start, as I say, the complaint may stand up without ERISA, but if you start litigating the case in a way that it does turn into a claim for benefits under the plan, you're going to get removed again.
I disagree with you. The problem with we're still at the inception of this case. This is here on de novo review. We've done no discovery into who the class members are. We allege that they were former employees, employees, and non-employees. So under Abraham, I don't know how you're going to remove it since the class is composed of non-employees. I also think, Judge Berzon, you pointed out that this may not even be an ERISA plan to begin with. It's an ESOP, an employee stock option plan.
Well, ESOPs are usually ERISA plans.
Regardless, the stock was moved out of the plan. It's gone. How can they unring the bell?
Okay. I take it, though, if they are right that this is really an ERISA claim, it looks like your federal securities claim has no basis anyway, right? Because you can't have both, can you?
Well, this was filed as a state action for violation.
No, but it's not what it is now. It's also a federal action today.
Well, they removed it on this ERISA preemption clause. It doesn't relate to ERISA in any way. It was based on stock violations.
I understand. But if you were wrong about that, then your federal securities claim falls too, correct?
Except that I would simply cite to cases that deal with the mishandling of stock, and there's probably 50 U.S. Supreme Court and California Supreme Court.
Thank you, misunderstand me. I'm saying, if indeed you were properly removed on ERISA, and if indeed this is a preempted ERISA case, that's what it is, then your federal securities claim would have to fall also, wouldn't it? Because you can't have both.
You're saying that if they were to succeed on ERISA preemption, then the federal securities claim would fall as well.
Would
it
not?
What you're saying?
Would it not? Because ERISA...
And I will explain why.
Explain.
Because the whole reason that Verizon exists is because of the securities laws. If I were to say there's a chicken and egg scenario here, the chicken are the securities laws, that form and allow Verizon to exist with its shareholders. You can't then bring in ERISA at a later date and say, well, no, ERISA then preempts all of the federal and state securities laws that guide the corporation, its bylaws, and securities ownership. I started to say I wanted to
direct it strikes me that the law is that if one has a, let's call it securities claim, and the claim really is the securities, I haven't been treated properly through my ERISA plan, and we're assuming for the moment that's what it is, then the federal securities law says nothing about that case. You can't bring a federal securities action. You have to bring an ERISA action, right?
Judge, you're struggling because they've rewritten the complaint and tried to cast it as an ERISA complaint.
I'm not struggling.
I simply like to cite a couple of things.
The one thing about you, you struggle with a nice smile. But, yeah.
Thank you.
You're struggling. No. And I'm just trying to figure out what's going on here. And I just, wonder, well, you know.
Judge Fernandez's point is simply that the interest that one holds in an ERISA plan is not subject to the securities laws. So if in fact we are talking about a right to a benefit under an ERISA plan where they're mutually exclusive, it can't be subject to the securities laws. That's it.
The problem, to answer the question, the problem that I have is that the stock was issued. It was held in their names. They would like now to bring it back within this ERISA plan, but it was already put out in circulation and transferred to different parties. And now they would like the shareholders, the minority shareholders, to go back to the ERISA plan, which we're pretty far afield from ERISA at this point. We're very far removed. And we're dealing with an independent corollary here, which are the securities laws. They're parallel tracks on the railroad. They're two separate
I thought we were dealing with chickens and eggs, not on railroads.
If I could close with that.
Don't put the egg on the rail.
Yes, Your Honor. The I think recently in Crayman versus Cohen, Lexis number 14380, you referred to a case, Schneider, and you said it's no different from holding a corporation liable when it gives away someone's shares under the same circumstances. That's the Ninth Circuit.
Oh, okay. Well,
Hurley versus Southern California Edison.
Must be right.
183, Fed Second, 125 at 130-131. We're talking about the general principle that property cannot be transferred without a person's assent. The maintenance of that principle is essential to the peace and safety of society, and the insecurity which would follow any departure from it would cause far greater injury than any which can fall in cases of unlawful appropriation of party upon those who have been misled and defrauded. That's a wrongful transfer of stock case. That's a United States Supreme Court, 1878. That is the public policy that we're talking about. I'm over time by 1 minute and 20 seconds. If there's any other further questions, I'll just submit.
Anything further?
Thank you.
Have a good day, and we'll take a 10-minute recess.